Dear Sugar is supported by
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
So, Steve, do you feel in your current life, or have you felt in your adult life, let us say, that you have carried some of the wounds from your childhood into it, or you recognize a pattern that's something that you've had since childhood and haven't ever been able to change or at least entirely lose?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've always had an incredible need for sort of intensity and reassurance, a neediness. And for a long time, had no clear idea of why I was sending that out into the world, needing from friends initially and then later in life from romantic interests, a certain kind of intensity. And it took me many years to figure out that I think what was going on is that as I've constructed my history, you know, my twin brother was more independent than me. He moved off into the world before me, and I never really got over it. It was kind of the central unrequited love of my early childhood, and I kept reenacting it. You know, when I was a kid, my mom tells the story. We would lie in the crib, and Mike would bonk his head, bonk, on the crib, and I would bonk. And he would go bonk, 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 and I would hit my head, bonk, bonk, bonk. I mean, I think it's at a level that's so deeply embedded in me that I just naturally expect it from the person who I choose to be my twin. And I have all these ideas about how close we're going to be, and it sends them screaming in the other direction, which in a sense is what I think happened, I think, deep down with my twin brother. But I experienced it as I've lost him, and I keep losing him again and again and again.
It's really connected to what we're going to talk about today, because most of these letters are about, you know, those childhood wounds or those patterns that were inflicted in a sort of family system.
Right.
And the same question of how do we evolve into the people we've grown into being as adults, while, you know, carrying with us all that we were and leaving behind some of those struggles and sorrows that hold us back.
Right. They're letters that are picking up on something we explored actually, you know, several months ago on the episode, The Wounded Child Within, which had to do with the way in which, Faulkner says this, you know, the past isn't past, it's not prologue, it's our present. The idea that what we've experienced in the past really is our fate, that we are doomed to repeat traumas and distressing relationships that take root within us when we're very young and we never escape from them. They amount to our destiny. And I think actually if we drill down, you know, maybe half of our letters, that anxiety is living at the bottom of whatever situation they're writing about in the present.
Right. And if you bore down a bit into the whole premise of our show, it's an argument against that, that we're saying, listen, we can be awake to those things that wounded us, and we can change the course of our lives with that kind of awareness and consciousness and mindfulness.
Right. Now, we're going to have some help, some professional help in plumbing those depths. And that person is near and dear to my heart, Dr. Richard Allman, Dr. Rick, who was our guest for The Wounded Child Within, where we started to explore this dynamic. We had such a strong response to that episode, and we kept encountering letters that were really about this question of, is the past damning my present and future? So we wanted to engage with some of those. We'll take one on, and then we'll invite Dr. Rick into the conversation. Dear Sugars, I have fallen madly in love with a wonderful man. He comes into my life after a series of bad relationships. One who tried to manipulate me into losing weight so I would become attractive to him again. One who denied my existence to his friends and acquaintances. A serial cheater. One who tried to gaslight me into believing we never had sex when we most certainly did. One who ended our relationship by simply declining to answer his phone or texts entirely. My current beloved is gentle, honest, genuine, excellent at communicating, and goes out of his way to make sure I feel safe, loved, respected, and included. I feel as though I finally understand what a healthy relationship looks like, and I learn from him every day how to be more open and loving. But, and isn't there always a but, he has grown up in a different culture around alcohol than I have, and I, the only child of two alcoholics, have a really hard time accepting his habits. I want to be absolutely clear. My boyfriend is not an alcoholic. He knows about my history with my parents and has been very respectful of my stated boundaries. He drinks moderately within the span of a night, tells me when he intends to drink a little more, and has never pressured me to remain in an environment with high levels of alcohol consumption, which can make me uncomfortable. But Sugars, we've been sharing a living space on a temporary basis while my apartment undergoes repairs, and I've noticed some things that make me really nervous. For example, I didn't realize how many days per week he has 3 or 4 beers, and my anxiety was obvious enough to him that we had to talk about it. He responded very well to my concerns, and his day-to-day alcohol consumption went down following that conversation. It's clear he heard what I had to say, which is all I can ask, really. But the conversation was still stressful for us both. I'm used to being extremely blunt about the realities of alcohol consumption amidst an extended family who denied there was a problem, and I usually sound angry when speaking on the topic of alcohol. To complicate matters, I also don't have a grasp on whether my past should impact his decisions, especially since his alcohol use has never made his behavior aggressive, erratic, or anything other than his usual loving and affectionate self. So I have a hard time feeling justified in my anxieties. Today we've had another discussion. We are both very nocturnal. He works nights. I'm an insomniac, which sometimes leads to very strange wake-up times. We woke up at 5 p.m., so I assumed we wouldn't be going to a party scheduled for that night until we'd been awake for a few hours. It turned out the party started earlier in the day and ended at 8, so he really wanted to go right away. To me, this said he was intending to drink all day and all night. I had a strong reaction. We talked and eventually figured out what the right steps were for both of us. He went to the party with the intention to stop drinking after a certain time so as not to be drinking all day, and I took some space to clear my head. But neither one of us is happy with the fact that we weren't at the party together as planned. He's deeply saddened that I feel as though I might have to spend more time apart from him, and we have spent a few weepy hours trying to figure out whether our relationship is still tenable. I'm 26 years old, and I've been out of my parents' house for 8 years. In that time, I've gone to therapy and support groups and done everything I can to help me live a life free of the influence of my parents' alcoholism. I'm so used to relying on myself to keep me safe, and if I'm reacting this strongly, maybe it would be healthiest for us both to go our separate ways, for me to do what I have to do and for him to do what he wants to do without interference. One thing being with him has taught me is that sometimes it's best to work through tough things with someone who loves you, and our ferocious love for each other is one thing that's not in doubt. But is that enough to keep us from fracturing over such a small issue that feels so big? Sincerely, Unchill.
Huh. Sometimes it helps to actually draw a map of your problem. Like, what's the trajectory? What's the source?
Mm-hmm.
And on this episode, obviously, we're circling back to that past, those patterns from the past.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, Unchill, that's where this sits. This isn't about your boyfriend or his drinking. You say over and over and over again, he's a moderate drinker. You don't think he has a problem. He doesn't think he has a problem. He never has behaved in any way
right. That
makes you uncomfortable. It's the drinking itself that makes you uncomfortable.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is we live in a world where people drink, and many of them drink destructively, like your parents on chill, but many of them also drink moderately and with no problem at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And clearly, you've fallen in love with somebody who is a drinker.
Right. Yeah. Underneath this, I thought, this guy sounds unbelievable, especially compared to this history of getting involved with men who were not there for you, who were, you know, ultimately very damaging.
Mm-hmm.
And Unchill, I did not grow up, you know, with parents who were alcoholics, and it sounds like destructive alcoholics in the way that your folks were, nor in a family system that therefore had to deny that alcohol was a problem. But it's worth thinking about whether to some extent you're sabotaging this relationship, because this is a guy who, it sounds like, very clearly deeply loves you, and you are, for understandable reasons, kind of characterizing what you recognize rationally and consciously as, you know, he gets up at 5, he wants to go to a party, he's willing to not drink too much, and to you, that's drinking all day and all night. That's not actually rational thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fair to him, and it's really not fair to you. You're sort of seeing the world through a brandy glass. It's all distorted.
I was struck also how patient he is about these conversations because, you know, I can see feeling defensive. I'm a moderate drinker. If I had a partner who was, you know, every time I drank, sort of watching me and having to have these big conversations, I'd feel defensive about it and maybe get a little impatient after a while. So that's another thing that he should be congratulated for. Until one of the things that I was struck by when I was trying to think about how you might find ways to resolve this issue and heal this wound is I noticed in your letter, you talked about your parents' relationship with alcohol and you talked about your boyfriend's relationship with alcohol, but you didn't talk about your relationship with alcohol. Essentially, your relationship with alcohol is defined by these parents who were alcoholics, and we don't know the blow-by-blow of what happened back there, but clearly it shaped you enormously and shaped your life to the point where you have one view of what alcohol is. There's something deeply essential in you that still thinks of alcohol as a great evil, a great force of destruction.
Yeah.
You know, alcoholism is a big deal, and it is the reason for so many bad things that happen in our world, okay? People die every day because of that disease, so that's no joke. But it's also true that alcohol is a wonderfully joyous presence in our lives, too. And I mean, it's not unlike people with eating disorders who have come to think of food mm-hmm. as poison, or food is like a toxic thing, and they have to essentially go on a journey to redefine their views of food or their relationship with food. I would, if I were you, really think about maybe doing some really intentional work with the focus of changing your ideas about what alcohol is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a sense, this is allowing your parents, who already have done a fair amount of damage, it sounds like, to undermine this relationship, you know. Now, you could certainly talk with him, and maybe you have, about what the attitudes of his family are towards alcohol, and that certainly matters. You know, if he's a guy who has three or four beers now, and you honestly think, well, maybe there's some family history that unsettles me and that could tilt towards use of alcohol that would be more destructive, okay, that's a reasonable conversation to have with him. But you seem to recognize that you are kind of retreating from him and using the alcohol as a pretext to avoid, like, committing to him and being in a deeply intimate relationship. And that could have to do with patterns in your past in which alcohol played a huge role in your parents' alcohol addiction, but it has more to do with a fear of being intimate with somebody and being that vulnerable to them because maybe you didn't feel safe, you know, growing up and with your parents because of their use of alcohol. That might also explain getting involved with men who, in the past anyway, have been guaranteed to push you away. But that doesn't have to do with booze anymore. I mean, I think we should be allowed. This guy, if he's has a rough time at work or goes out and parties, he's in his 20s, goes out and parties with some friends of his, I think he should be allowed to, you know, get hammered. I don't think he should make a habit of it. But do you see what I mean? If that's something that's going to be a deal breaker for you down the line, then it's kind of a ticking time bomb because, mm-hmm. you know, this guy already feels like he's dealing with it well, but he's under surveillance from you. He knows that you're watching and counting how many drinks. And it is, I think the analogy to food issues is a good one because the irony here is you really are much more focused on alcohol than he is. Mm-hmm. You're obsessed with it. And for him, it's just something that probably helps him relax and unwind, and it's part of his lifestyle.
Yeah. Steve, remember last year we did a show on deal breakers.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all have a right to have whatever it is be our deal breaker in a relationship. Mm-hmm. And Anshul, you have the right to have alcohol consumption be your deal breaker.
Right.
But what happens when you do name a deal breaker is that that's the deal then. You need to relinquish this relationship and you need to go find big love with somebody who takes a vow of sobriety.
Right.
And so, you know, one of the things we talked about on that episode is a lot of times people do exactly what this point you come to at the close of your letter, Anshul, where you say, okay, the easier thing might be for me to break up with him.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing you say that being in a relationship has taught you is that, quote, sometimes it's best to work through tough things with someone who loves you.
Yeah.
And I think that this is one of those cases. I don't think that it's a good idea that you let alcohol be your deal breaker, even though it gives you some comfort and feels easier for you to not have to be confronting this with a partner. I do think confronting it with this partner is worth that effort. You know, this is something that you're going to have to confront over the course of your life. And what better time to do it than now?
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, I was thinking, okay, so maybe she goes and she finds somebody who's quote unquote sober. that's not going to stop her from being obsessed with alcohol. And the person who she becomes when she is obsessed, which is, by her own description, angry, somewhat paranoid. And it seems to me what this boyfriend is offering you is, to some extent or another, forgiving your parents for the fact that they were addicted to alcohol and were destructive around it. In a sense, by hanging on to the anger and rage and grievance around both their alcoholism and the family's, the extended family's denial of it as a problem, that's the force. It's mm-hmm. the hanging on to that rage and anger at them that's causing you to treat your biggest ally as an enemy, or somebody anyway who's under suspicion.
Yeah, I think that deep work needs to be done. But one last thought that I have for you, Anshel, too, is I was thinking about all the alcoholics in recovery. I know the sober people who, for whom alcohol really was a dark and destructive force. And I can't think of one of them who isolates him or herself from people who use alcohol moderately. You know, I think that one of the sort of pieces of the journey in most people's sobriety, most alcoholic sobriety journey, is about learning how to be in the presence of alcohol, be in the presence of drinkers, without having some of these, you know, essentially struggles and difficulties that you're having, Anshel.
Right.
You know, I'm sure that didn't happen overnight. It involves, at the outset when I said, I think you need to redefine your relationship with alcohol, which sounds a little odd because you don't drink, and yet you have this big relationship with alcohol. It's this gigantic dark force in your life, and you need to redefine that. And once you do, once you confront that, the way other people drink around you is going to be not so important.
Right. The goal is to not repeat the pattern where alcohol rules your life.
That's right.
So let's call in the big guns here, Cheryl. Let's give Dr. Rick a call because we got a couple more bruiser letters to try to figure out here.
We do.
Hello.
Hey, Dad.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Rick. This is Cheryl Strayed. How are you?
Okay.
Just in case you had too much free time on your hands, we need you to help us figure out a few things. We are talking today about the idea of the past as the present. And I was hoping before we read a couple of letters, you know, Cheryl and I want to hear your thoughts about this, since you spent a lot of your life's work mulling these questions of how the past informs the present.
Right.
What about personally? I mean, we're going to tap into your professional wisdom and experience. But one question I have for you, personally, if you could talk to us about, do you have patterns that have carried over into your adult life from your childhood? And what are they? And how have you addressed them?
Yes, is the short answer. yes. And you know, I've spent a lot of time when I'm not working thinking about that. Kind of a basic example has to do with having a mother who had a great deal of anxiety about being competent and successful, especially the latter, and as a result made it very tense about her kids being successful. And, you know, one thing I realized is that I married someone who was not so conflicted. Of course, the story gets much more complicated as you live it out over many years. But that was one pattern that I realized had to do with who I chose to spend my life with, that I was in some way trying to find someone who was the opposite of what I'd struggled with myself.
Hmm. Do you find in your work and also in your life that that's a successful strategy to actually find the opposite of whatever pattern was wounding to you in your childhood?
I think it's more complicated in the sense that when you find someone different, then you find there are other issues. There are always issues. And one of the things that I think I noticed in some of the letters was a kind of idealization of partners in fairly new relationships. I mean, in fact, it's not like there's just the right person, you know, the opposite of your problematic parent, or the same as a good parent, a parent you're comfortable about. It always works out in reality to be a complex struggle over time.
Right. I grew up in northern Minnesota, where the roads are often icy. And I would find often if I was about to go into the ditch on the right side of the road, I'd overcorrect and end up going into the ditch on the left side of the road. So maybe that it's like a metaphor of what you do. If you avoid this, you go into this other thing, and it has its own consequences, right?
Right. And don't they say in driving school, you know, if you go into a skid, you have to know the counter-logical way?
That's right.
You have to turn into the skid.
You have to turn into the skid.
Yeah.
So, you know, this
That's what this
episode is about. What to do in the skid. Do you turn into it? And then how the hell do you get out of it?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to read the first letter.
Yeah, let's do it.
Dear Sugars, I'm a 29-year-old woman living with my boyfriend and our two precious cats. We've been together 4 years and speak frequently about when we're married. This last summer, I had a long-awaited reckoning about my childhood, and I'm coming to terms with the fact that my father is an addict of many forms, whom I'm positive has narcissistic personality disorder. I'm actively trying to reframe our relationship, past, present, and future, with this knowledge, and set healthy emotional boundaries. It's been hugely helpful, but also heartbreaking and infuriating. My dad is a gregarious, charming man, wildly talented in everything he pursues, and he was a magical person to me as a child. Literally, he was also a magician. But in the privacy of our home, he could also be very emotionally abusive. There's a well-developed side of him that is dark, punitive, tyrannical, unreasonable, and lacking in empathy. His ability to say the most unspeakable and hurtful things when he's angry still confounds me, and I remember all of them. His response to our hurt? Don't step in front of a cannon while it's going off. My boyfriend and I have been through so much the last 4 years, and he has stuck with me through all of it. I really can't imagine my life without him. He's my best friend, my buddy, my lover. He's driven, talented, funny, playful, and perhaps most importantly, eager to be a healing agent so that we may not repeat the damaging patterns of our parents. I feel we have dug deep through a lot of issues. His abuse of alcohol is one of them, and we're in therapy for it. I'm writing to you because lately he's been reminding me so much of my father, and it's incredibly worrisome. He's angry when he comes home from work and can't seem to be consoled. He talks at me with an unending diatribe of all the things people in his life are doing wrong. His ego, much like my dad's, is so tied up in his career. If things are going great, everyone is happy. If they aren't so great, the opposite is true. He's confided in me while feeling defeated by his career that he should just kill himself, something my father threatened our family with several times when I was a child. A few areas where he differs greatly from my father is that my boyfriend can apologize. He will sit and talk through something with me, and I believe he really does love me, whereas I don't think my dad loved my mom, at least not in the way two people in a marriage should. My question to you is, am I projecting my wounds onto a good man and potentially sabotaging our relationship and myself? Or are my fears valid, and am I recognizing red flags when my mother and all of her divorced friends wish they had? I just can't bear the thought of living what my mother, now 60, calls a wasted life. I saw her clean up my father's physical and emotional messes for 25 years. They've been divorced for the past 5 years. I saw how much she shrank in his presence. And I saw her heart break slowly every day. I so badly want to transcend the patterns of my parents, but I recognize so much of her behavior in myself and my father's in my boyfriend. Why have I fallen in love with and begun to build a life with a man who reminds me so much of my dad? Is there hope for us? Is this story written? Signed, Patterns. All right, Dr. Rick, what do you think of that letter?
Well, let me say a word that's a little bit theoretical about how we think about this issue of the past reappearing in the present, which is what this writer is concerned about. Has she found someone just like her father, and is she going to repeat her mother's pattern and end up disappointed and divorced and so on?
Yeah.
What I want to say, backing off in the specifics of this writer, is that in recent years, psychoanalysis and a lot of therapeutic thinking has been about attachment theory. And essentially, that's that the shape of our attachments, but also who we are, is very much colored by early experience, and particularly the patterns that develop with our mothers heavily and our fathers as well. Things like how do we manage our feelings and who do we feel is a recognizable other person from whom we get security. If we're fortunate and have empathic and loving and flexible parents, we end up more secure and therefore more able to attach to a variety of different kinds of people and to be able to sort ourselves out between them and ourselves and our parents, the kind of thing we're talking about. But parents who are lacking due to their own early experiences usually lead to some kind of distortion in the attachment pattern. And then it's more likely that people end up looking for someone who's a lot like the parent. Or, as in this letter, you know, they get confused about the partners they choose. Are they really a replica of the problematic parent? Or is that just how they're experiencing it? Now, this is something that this writer actually says, and she's not sure, and she admits she's confused about it.
Well, there are certain similarities, though, that she does recognize in terms of, you know, his threatening suicide, for instance, which is something that the dad did several times, she says, and having this kind of manic-y fluctuation between everything's great, everyone's happy as long as I'm doing well in my work, but if things go wrong, he becomes angry and aggrieved and, you know, aims all of that at her and these unending diatribes. I mean, those similarities are pretty direct.
Right, right. And that may well be a clue that she has chosen someone who is close to her father in his character and his capacity for constructive relating. She also, you know, talks about being able to talk things through with him,
mm-hmm.
you know, which may be a difference. And that's what makes this so difficult. And, you know, I can't tell, and probably there is no simple answer as to, you know, whether this is the right guy or the wrong guy.
Right.
So I'm curious about that. I mean, could it be that she's drawn to some characteristics of her father, but that this relationship is in some ways a sign of progress for her?
Right. An improvement.
An improvement upon the original model?
That's right. And often, you know, in my work with people, I see young people, let's say in their 20s, going through a series of relationships, some of which replicate old patterns. And as we work on these things and they get more conscious of what they're doing, they kind of do successive approximations to something better. The difficulty being that I think there is a tendency among probably everyone to look for something familiar, you know, because it feels like home. You know, people who are abused by parents as children, they seek out abusers, you know. So, I mean, that's the extreme case, but people do look for something that registers on their inner radar as familiar because that's who they felt connected to when they were kids.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it seems striking, Dad, because you were talking about the sort of our tendency to almost bifurcate, and there's kind of the opposite of Dad, and then underneath that is, oh, no, actually, he is Dad, when in fact he has some of her father's qualities, probably, clearly, but he also has certain capacities that her father didn't have. And more important than that, and this is the part of the letter I really picked up on, what was the example she had from her mother? Well, she saw how her mother shrank in the presence of her father and allowed herself to just become a kind of assistant or adjunct. So the question is, in working with somebody like this, Pop, would you focus on their capacity to essentially refuse to shrink in the face of this guy's, the parts of his personality that are more damaged and damaging?
Yeah, you'd certainly try to sort out in the degree to which she's playing her mother's part. And hopefully that would, in a way, allow her to put the issue to the test. That is, if she starts acting less codependent, you know, less facilitating to his moodiness and, you know, so forth, then does he react in a negative way,
right,
by sort of getting worse, or does he respond positively?
Right. And one thing I want to note, she says that they're in therapy for his, in response to his alcohol problem.
Right.
Which is, you know, I'm sure it's a great thing, and it offers enlightenment beyond this issue of alcohol, but it is focused on him and his problem.
Right.
And she's writing to us about her problem, which I want to remind you of that patterns. We're not talking about your boyfriend. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about your boyfriend's problem and how he should change or what he should do, or he shouldn't act like your dad, or he should, but what you want in your life and the kind of relationship you want to have with your partner. And so I think that, you know, taking a step back and assessing if that therapy that you're getting with him is really addressing these questions that you're posing to us.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very astute point, Cheryl. I often say to people, if they're in a couple therapy, you know, what about you? You know, the couple therapist is essentially committed to working with the relationship. So the couple therapist can't work on both the individuals at once. The couple therapy is for the couple. When I see people individually, I'm very wary if they want to do couple therapy in order to fix something about the partner. Mm. There may well be something that needs to be fixed in a partner, but that really can only be done by the partner. So to go into a therapy just to fix a partner usually is doomed. So I agree, Cheryl, with your advice to her to, you know, look for herself, either in therapy or just looking inwards and raise the kind of questions she's raising for herself.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, listen, we're going to do our final letter here. I promise you, Pop, it's another bruiser. And it goes like this. Dear Sugars, I've always had this strong belief that if a mother doesn't resolve her issues before she has children, that unfinished business will be carried forth into the next generation. I fear I'm the recipient of this kind of karmic residue. My mother lives a solitary life with few relationships to speak of, and increasingly she's become more and more isolated. She's in her early 60s now and has been single for 33 years, ever since she and my father divorced when I was 3 years old. My sister and I are grown now and spread across the country. My sister with a husband and two small children of her own, and me, well, I'm 36 years old and single. Like my mother, I've not had a relationship in over 12 years. I'm deeply concerned that I'm headed down the same path as her, and at the same time acutely aware that my fear might also be driving my failed destiny. We recently visited my mother at her home in Arizona, and it's become clear that she is at a point of no return. Her transformation over the last 5 years is striking. Once a youthful and beautiful dance therapist with crystal blue eyes weighing only 110 pounds, she is now a morbidly obese woman who can barely stand up or walk a block with her grandchildren. She lives such a sad life, and it is so painful and aggravating to watch her waste her life away. It seems like she has just given up on life. Undoubtedly, mental illness plays a role, but there have been so many choices she's made over the years that have gotten her to where she is now, and my sister and I are going to have to deal with the repercussions of what's imminently ahead, namely her failing health and lack of employment or savings. The saddest part is that all she's ever wanted was to be a good mother. She had to give up custody of my sister and I when we were young, which seems to have haunted her whole life. She lives in a fantasy world. To her, my sister and I are still young children and her only source of pride and joy. We are, and have always been, her entire world. However, being miles apart and now both grown, the physical and emotional separation between us has gotten even wider, making her empty life that much more apparent. My sister has a family of her own and barely has any time to even call my mother. I'm alone, and my aloneness is magnified when I speak to my mother because I'm reminded that my life all too closely resembles hers. She's also aware of this, and I can sense her shame and disappointment. This dynamic is damaging our already precarious relationship. I'm increasingly getting angrier and resentful of her, but at the same time, I feel such grief for how things have turned out for her. I realize it's a lot like the pot calling the kettle black, but I have this deep-seated feeling that unless my mother clears up her life, mine will always be stuck the way it is. I feel this awful burden and responsibility to change her so that things can get right with me, like if she made steps to change her life, mine would suddenly get better. Why can't I move on while my sister is off living a full life? How can I come to acceptance about who my mother is and has become when I know she can do so much better for herself? Why does it matter so much to me? Am I doomed to repeat all her mistakes? She has no other cheerleaders in her life. I feel like I'm her only one. How can I break this cycle so that I can live an independent life and perhaps have a partner and children of my own someday without them inheriting this great karmic burden? Signed, Let the Circle Be Broken.
That's
well,
a sad letter.
That's a very, yeah, yeah.
It's a deeply sad letter.
What do you think, Pop?
Well, I think this is an example of a, as we're all agreeing, a more troubling situation. And it involves psychologically what we call a pathological identification, which is, you know, a complicated way of saying she can't really sort herself out separately from her mother. Probably this had something to do with her being emotionally more tuned into the mother. In some way, a kind of unfortunate capacity to feel her mother's unhappiness and trying, as a child even, to find ways to connect and to make the mother feel better. She describes quite honestly the fantasy wish that if the mother could be cured, then she would be freed and she would be better. Well, that represents an inability to sort herself out from her mother. Her mother is clearly not going to get better, and probably this woman's involvement with the mother even may contribute to that, in the sense of kind of supporting the mother in her, you know, unrealistic fantasy that her daughters can make her feel okay.
Yeah. You know, the sister seems to have been the one who was able to individuate and, you know, have a family and not feel guilty and bound up, where Let the Circle Be Broken sounds like she has this kind of doomed loyalty to her mom. If that's the case, do you help people come to a place where they can move away from that parent or that identification that's holding them back?
Well, you know, she uses at one point the word grief, and that's really at the center of what has to happen. That is, there has to be a grieving process, mm-hmm. in which what's given up is not so much the external relationship, although the people I've worked with who have this kind of pattern often have to really break off with the parents for a period of months or years sometimes in order to achieve the inner change, the inner mm-hmm. separation from that parent. So the process of therapy, there's no one path for it, and it's often very hard to change these things where people are on some level getting a gratification out of a kind of victimhood, or, you know, technically we would call it masochism. There's often a hidden kind of pride, and you kind of pick it up in this letter, and that is often very hard to get at, because it's what people are aware of is their unhappiness and their own isolation, but not the satisfactions they're getting out of continuing this pattern. So it's working on that kind of thing that can eventually lead to the grief process and the giving up of this special but distorted relationship. And then sometimes they can actually have a decent relationship with the parent, but one that's much more realistic.
Right.
As I thought about this letter, I kept thinking about fairy tales. It has a fairy tale quality. And I think that the reason I was thinking about the fairy tales is so often a classic fairy tale will have some deep, dark wound that happened a long time ago. And then it's like essentially it's brought to bear in the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
And the next generation can only be freed of this once that magic key is found. And then happiness and light will be restored to the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what happens really quickly in this letter is she mentions this little part that is a big part for me. And that is, she says, the saddest part is all she ever wanted to be was a good mother.
Right.
She had to give up custody of my sister and I when we were young. Okay, I'm going to presume this is when the letter writer was three, when her parents got divorced.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big wound. That's a big wound to experience as a child. And it's a big wound as a mother, too. What I want you really to hear so clearly, Let the Circle Be Broken, is that it's not your fault that your mother suffered this wound.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't do anything as a daughter to make your mother suffer as a mother. You are her joy. And the fact that her journey as a mother has been full of sorrow is not your fault. It has nothing to do with you. You can love your mother without being codependent with her. And I do think that really, you know, for you, what you need to look at is, what does that mean? I mean, maybe you don't even know what that means. Because I can imagine being that three-year-old who was told you don't get to live with your mom anymore. And what I would do every time I did see my mom is I would try to make it right for her. I would
right.
try to make it okay for her.
Yeah.
I would try to reassure her. This is a really compassionate woman who's written us this letter. I mean, I think I would feel the exact same way. I really would, because I too deeply, deeply identify with my mother. But I think that in your case, it's gone haywire and it hasn't served you. And it also hasn't served your mom. And really, the greatest gift you could give your mom is to let her go so that you can go on and thrive. And then what she does in response to that is really not up to you.
Right.
Yeah, I probably have a somewhat darker view of the situation, but that's being a therapist. I'm not sure whether this mother, probably because of her depression, is really able to value her daughters as the one thing she's done right in her life. If that was really true, why can't the mother get it together for herself, which would really be the kindest thing she could do for her daughters, mm-hmm. and say to this, the letter writer, you need to live your own life. I think people really do get into parasitic kinds of relationships, and when they're disappointed with their own lives, sort of take advantage of a dutiful child in this way. And it comes to the same bottom line that you said, Cheryl, which is that she's got to separate herself and do what I think in the end would make her mother happier, which is be successful for herself and happy for herself, partly because sometimes the child has to lead the parent.
Right.
And the child has to get better first. And then the parent can sort of observe that and realize that, she's allowed to get better too.
Yeah. I wonder about the idea also of resilience. They're two daughters. And, what you're suggesting, Dad, is that she was more sensitive to her mom and felt cast into the role, as certain kids will be, of, the one who's going to take care of the mother. Certain kids decide, and they do get a form of gratification, they're closer to the mother. Say what you will, she's the one who's closer to this mother who was absent, right, when she was young. It might be a distorted, damaging kind of intimacy, but it's very present. And yet at the same time, sometimes other children are sort of more resilient, and they recognize, I can't save this person. In fact, they're going to pull me down unless I get away. To what extent is that resilience something that is characterological, and how much of it is something that through difficult work and therapy and whatever else you have to do can be learned or developed?
There certainly are inbuilt differences in resilience. It's a very hot topic in psychology at the moment, identifying kind of what are the traits that indicate a person has that. On the other hand, the whole thing gets very complicated because sometimes some of the sterling traits, like being sensitive and empathic, can be a door towards, being seduced into the helping role and being trapped in a kind of unending parent-child support relationship, as in this case. We don't know how happy the sister is. Sometimes people who get away from bad situations carry with them a lot of things. And then, as in our first letter, then they end up repeating things. We don't know anything about that in this case. But resilience, if it's truly there, I think would involve being able to do the kind of psychological work you're talking about of attending to her own life and at the same time, where she can, being able to be a support and express her love towards her mother.
I also feel like really the occasion for the letter is the realization that she is going to have to let go of the idealized version of her mother, who was never there, I think, really in a very present way for reasons that are completely justifiable in the mother's own. It's not a criticism, but it's an observation. This was a mom who, for whatever complicated set of reasons, was not able to really be the mother. And instead, there's this fantasy life that she's developed. Mm-hmm. And she's gotten you, Let the Circle Be Broken, to kind of buy into that. The problem is, you know it's not true, and you know that it's damaging to you, and you're furious at her about it. You've got to forgive her and mourn the person that she couldn't be and the mother that she couldn't be. And at that point, I think it'll be much easier to do the sort of therapeutic work that would help her develop healthy relationships, stop being the daughter, and start being the person who has her own life and mm-hmm. her own family if she wants it.
Thank you, Dr. Rick, for delving into these questions with us. I always love talking to you. I think you offer such really great insight, and we appreciate it so much, taking the time to consider these letters.
It was fascinating, and the two of you have a lot of insights yourself. I think what you said today has been very helpful to many people.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yeah, you know, all three of these letters, it seems to me what's so hopeful about what they're bringing, even though the stories are very sad and worrying, is that they recognize in every one of the letters that they had parents who were disappointing to them. At the bottom of it are flawed parents, alcoholic parents, a father who was tyrannical and unloving to his mother, a mom who was deeply damaged and unable to really take care of her daughters. And that's absolutely heartbreaking. But to me, the light here is that every single one of these women who's written to us recognizes that their parents failed them. And that I think the undercurrent, the thing that I would sort of see that connects all of them is you're not going to find a way forward until you are able to not just recognize that, but forgive them for not being stronger people and for not being more able to love you as parents really should. And having done that, to look towards trying to do better themselves. It's hard because none of us really at the bottom of it want to leave our parents behind, even the bad ones. And sometimes if your parents were, you know, troubled and messed up, the way that you stay close to them is by doing that. But I think that all these letter writers have reached a moment in their lives where they've realized that's a dead end and they want to go in another direction.
You know, one thing to really remember is these are the problems, the biggest struggles of our lives. They're not the things that get resolved in a couple of therapy sessions or, you know, over the course of a winter or
right.
a podcast. And I think that these letters, the fact that they were even written.
Exactly.
It takes a lot to compose the sorts of letters that these three right. women composed and sent to us.
Right.
And so I want to say, there you are. You've begun the important journey and keep going.
Yeah. And to other people who are listening, you know, we're not done with this subject because actually so many of the letters that we look at in one way or another trace back to, you know, what we always say, you have to go back to the beginning to get to the bottom of it. You know, if you're struggling and you feel compelled to write us a letter, you might think as you're composing that letter, whether you're going to send it to us or not, where did this come from?
Mm-hmm.
Dear Sugar Radio is produced by WBUR in Boston. We're produced and edited by Lisa Tobin, and we are recording at Talkback Sound and Visual here in Portland, Oregon. Josh Millman is our engineer. You should listen and subscribe to Dear Sugar on iTunes and also find the WBUR Dear Sugar webpage where we will have links to books and music, everything that we mention on the podcast. And please, as noted, write to us at DearSugarRadio@gmail.com.